Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, the sun and fun capital of the world. This is the one, the only Scarycast. We are so glad to be with everyone tonight. We got some great guests. We have a former co-host of Scarycast who's made it big. We've got his writing partner who has made it big, and we're just so glad to have him here. And plus, all of a sudden everybody wants to talk to me, but that's okay. So anyway, you know how it is when you run something on a cell phone. But anyway, tonight our co-hosts, we're going to have four of them, but two of them are here with us right now. First of all, from Niagara Falls, Canada, that crazy but very smart Canadian. I hope you don't mind me calling you crazy, but very smart, Mark. Mark Johnson, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, John. No, I don't mind being called crazy. I think it's appropriate for the show. We're looking at things that are out there, all different types of topics. I think you have to be a little crazy to study cryptids and aliens and that type of thing.
I don't. This is my normal day, so anyway, that's okay. I'll agree with you, and we're so glad to have you here. And from Houston, Texas, one of the co-hosts of the world-famous Houston Bigfoot, because he's from Houston. Kyler Smith, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good, John. I'm excited, and I'm having a good day.
Well, that's great. We're glad to have you here. Now, I want to make two announcements that are very important to Scarycasters worldwide. First of all, tomorrow night on Houston Bigfoot, right here at 9 p.m., we are going to have Matt Delf and we are going to have Elijah Henderson. Now, why are they important? Matt Delf's getting a lot of press, number one. Elijah Henderson, his parents were the preeminent researchers for Dogman at Land Between the Lakes. And it is incredible. So, and we're getting notices that we've got, So anyway, we're going to have them on tomorrow night. And this is the Surgeon General of Scarycast, the number one dude, Dr. Trey Dunaway. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, John. Nice to hear you guys, and happy to be here.
We are glad you're here. I was announcing tomorrow night we've got Elijah Henderson, who is his parents were world experts on Dogman. They researched Dogman for over 30 years. Both of his parents passed away. And he is now an expert on Appalachian sorcery, believe it or not. And he has given me some books to read. We're going to talk with him hopefully next week on Scarycast. That will be a landmark episode because some of his relatives were, as he calls them, granny witches. And they could do spells. And it's going to be so much fun. So anyway, that's what we got going on, Scarycast Houston Bigfoot. And anybody wants to join us on Houston Bigfoot, come on. Mark, we'd love to have you because it's going to be fine. Same bat time, same bat channel. So tonight, we have a former co-host of Scarycast and his writing partner. This is Tony Filosi and his writing partner, Darla. Tony and Darla, how are you folks doing tonight?
We're doing wonderful, John. And we're glad to be here. Looking forward to the show. We have some really spectacular information to share with you about the Manzo Shepherd story.
Well, that's great. And Darla, it's so good to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Yes, I'm very excited to be back and giving an update of a previous show that we did. So we've got exciting stuff coming up.
Well, that's great. So we're going to ask you to, first of all, a number of our listeners will probably not remember Manzo Shepherd because they weren't around. This was almost a couple years back. So if the two of you would remind us of this great, great story, it was one of the most, I mean, I hate to call it this, but it was one of the most spectacular murders on the East Coast. And I believe it was in the 1930s. Is that correct, Tony?
1940s. Darla's going to give us the recap. But before we get started, I want to, again, thank Darla for the the book. Without Darla, Manzo Shepherd would never have been written. I had researched him for years and years and couldn't get anybody interested in the book. And I've known Darla for, you know, I'm not going to say how many years I've known Darla. It's been a long time. And,
it's been a minute.
It's been a minute. She said she got some time. You know, Darla's a very successful author. And, you know, she has won an Emmy, actually, with Mountain Jane Doe. And I just kind of ran into her, been talking to her about doing some projects anyway. And she found some time, and she helped. She actually, I did the research, and Darla wrote the Manzo Shepherd story. She did a phenomenal job, brought him to life. And I can't say enough good things about how that she, with the work that she did on the Manzo Shepherd book. And again, without Darla, there would be no Manzo Shepherd book today. So thank you, Darla.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Tony. So I guess for our new listeners that weren't here way back two years ago when we actually did a full podcast on the Manzo Shepherd story, I'll just give just a brief summary of this. I guess it would be an infamous murder and trial story that actually occurred in Harlan County, Kentucky in the spring of 1942. And it is basically where three young men who are destined to get into trouble, it seemed to be their goal in life, or at least two of them, Manzo Shepherd being the ringleader of this threesome of young criminals, they actually brutally murdered a taxi cab driver. Excuse me. And they murdered a fellow named Joe Christian on the highest peak in the state of Kentucky, which is Black Mountain, located in the northeastern section of Harlan County. They tried to get away. They did very stupid things, and eventually got caught. Not long after, just weeks after, a trial occurred, and one of the trials ended with an actual murder happening in the courtroom, in which Manzo Shepherd, during his trial, was shot down and killed by a family member of the taxi cab driver. And because of this, it's probable that the court trial eclipsed the crime itself, the murder, and it really focused on a murder in the Harlan County courthouse. Then the two surviving young men, one being a man named Howard Hensley, they actually had to stand trial and sit in basically the same seat in which Manzo Shepherd had been murdered, being tried first for the first, you know, for the ringleader of this murder. So it is a tale that is very intriguing. It was easy to write because it just, you can't make stuff like this up. It was just recording these unbelievable events that happened in, I guess, what everyone knows as Bloody Harlan is the actual name that most people know Harlan County, Kentucky by. And I got with Tony, and we started talking about writing, and I read his notes, and like the book itself, really, it was just a very easy topic to write about because it was so exciting. And I think we finished the book in, I'm going to say it was 2020, spring of 2020, and we were excited about it. We were doing podcasts and really publicizing the release of the book. And as we were going through this, we stumbled across some information due to Ancestry.com genealogy et cetera, that we truly did not know. And Tony, I don't know if you want to do the big reveal here, but after years of researching, now I'm thinking he researched close to 10 years, maybe more, a decade of research and being nearly obsessed with this story, telling the tale, gathering every piece of information that he could from it. What did we learn, Tony?
Well, we had put the book out in that spring, and there was also a movie that had been done maybe a year or so previous, but I received that Chris Maggard had done and Thomas Markman himself, and I received an email from a lady in Ohio. And they've asked me not to use their names, but so she says, "Hey, I'd like to talk to you more about the Manzo Shepherd story." And of course, I said, "Well, Sherry, what would you like to talk about?" She said, "I'd like to set up a call between you and my dad." And I said, "Well, okay. Is your dad interested? Does he like the book?" She goes, "My dad is Howard Hensley's son, so I like to fell out of my chair because he is the last known living witness. I spoke to Stanley probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, interviewed him again for about an hour or so, and he's the last known living witness to the killing in 1942. He was six or seven years old. So I say, yeah, man, I'd love to talk to him. So she sets up a phone call where she's screening me, you know, and making sure that I'm legit, I guess. And so I'm talking to her, and she's in the conversation. She says, yeah, they went and lived at after the murder. They went and lived with his grandfather for a little bit, William Henry Hensley. And I said the William Henry Hensley from Smith, Kentucky. And then she says, yes. And I go, ma'am, I said, that's my grandmother's dad. And there's big silence. And, you know, she's thinking I'm jerking her chain, you know, whatever. And she says, oh, well, what's your grandmother's name then? And I said, Elvie. And another big, long silence. She says, oh, my God. I have a photograph of your grandmother holding my dad as a child. So it turns out that one of the murderers is my great uncle, who is my grandmother's brother. Howard Hensley is my grandmother's brother. And we confirmed all this on Ancestry.com. And Stanley Hensley is my second cousin. So,
all right. Now, Tony, this is Dr. John. I've got two important early questions for you. Number one, I want to recount what I remember about the murder. Is that is it Mr. Christian's nephew got up, took a gun out, and shot Manzo Shepherd in the back of the head and killed him in the middle of the courtroom in front of God and everybody else, correct?
About 300 people, yes. It was a packed courtroom, yes.
Right. And then what happened, I was talking with Kyler about this a little bit earlier, but tell us a little bit about his quick trial and fate, because I think that's the single most interesting thing about the Manzo Shepherd case is what happened to the murderer of Manzo Shepherd.
It was up until you get to hear the rest about Stanley Hensley. The what happened is Jack Heaton walked. He just walked up. He's the nephew of Joe Christian. He walks up through the everybody sitting in pews. There's like a couple of big sections of them. There's aisles in between them. So he walks up and just leans up and shoots Manzo in the back of the head. Then he stands trial, and he turns and surrenders the pistol. I think he stands trial, what is it, Darla, 8 or 9 months later, stands trial?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. And then so the jury, he goes on trial. They ask, why did you do this? Did you do this? Of course I did it. He goes, he turned around, he looked at my mother, he laughed. My mother's distraught. She starts wailing. Everything goes black. I walk up, and I shoot him in the back of the head. So many words. And I said, that's it? He goes, yeah, that's it. I went crazy, and I shot him. So the jury deliberated. There was some back and forth with the prosecution and defense. The jury deliberated about 10 minutes, and I think the jury foreman was a female named Frazier, Miss Frazier. And whenever they come back out, Judge Forrester, he's the judge. The judge looks at her and says, Madam Foreman, have you reached a verdict? She says, we have, Your Honor. And he says, what's the verdict? And she says, she looks dead at Jack Heaton and says, not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. Judge slaps the gavel down, releases him. He dies. Jack Heaton dies of natural causes in Los Angeles, California in 1982. That's Kentucky justice.
That I think, sir, is the single most incredible moment in American justice history when she says not guilty because of reasons of intemporary sanity, bang, and it's over. And I think, and I believe, and now, Tony, if you don't mind, I want to do a quick round of questions of our panelists, and I want to say it just sounds like justice was served because these boys brutally murdered Joe Christian, didn't they?
Brutal murder.
They brutally murdered him on the top of. Yeah, that's right. They slit his throat. It was horrible. And I don't know, maybe I'm a bad guy. Dr. Trey Donnelly, what do you think about justice being served like this?
Well, and I'm not a lawyer, obviously, and there is a word for that, and it's where the jury, they don't disregard the evidence. They just kind of say, well, he had it coming, and they're not gonna convict the person who did it. It's not because they didn't prove it. They proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, but with our jurisprudence system, you can appeal to the jury, and if the jury says you're not guilty, you're not guilty. And I can't remember the name of that, but there's a legal term for that, and I am looking it up while I speak. But that's it happens where even though the evidence is pretty ironclad and the guilt is obvious, I mean, it was witnessed by 300 people, the jury will just decide to acquit because, like he needed a killing.
Well, he apparently did, and he apparently needed to kill him. He did kill him, and that was apparently justice served. Mark Johnston, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think the temporary insanity for a defense is a good one. Maybe in this case, it apparently worked. I don't know how often that will work, but it seemed I found that very interesting that they called that to the defense.
I found it. It says it's jury nullification. Basically, when the jury ignores the law. And that's it. They're explained things, and the jury just they nullify it. So that's it.
they just do what they do, and that's it, right?
Yep. And I would think here it is. Here's a quote. I don't know who it's quoted by, but it says, the jury is the conscience of society, and their job is not only to decide whether the defendant did the acts charged, but whether he should be condemned and punished for it. The jury protects us from immoral or socially undesirable results. So juries have the power to ignore the law. So, yes, they decided that he did it. but he shouldn't be condemned or punished for it. End of case.
That
now,
is
there
a,
was
that
another
is a
interesting, another
jury
interesting
nullification.
Fact that the judge did. Do you remember what the judge, Judge Forrester, did, Darla?
No, not really.
Where they found him, he ordered the jury to deliberate?
No.
Okay. That, what happened was when Madzo Shepherd was shot, and we'll get more into Stanley Hensley because Stanley gave us the eyewitness view and walked us through the courtroom while Darla and I interviewed him and showed us exactly where Madzo Shepherd fell. And I was pretty close. I was within 3 or 4 feet of my calculations, according to newspaper articles. But Judge Forrester, when Madzo Shepherd was shot, he was leaning against a partition. And he obviously, he died instantly, and he's just slumped down into this partition. Judge Forrester ordered him to be carried to the nearest hospital, which was 3-4 blocks away. Then he ordered the jury to deliberate and pass judgment on him because the judge said he was still alive. He wanted to give the family closure. The jury deliberated about 15 minutes and came back. And this is backed up by multiple newspaper articles, accounts. And he asked them, have they decided a verdict? Yes, Your Honor, we have. We find the defendant, Madzo Shepherd, guilty as charged. We recommend death by electrocution. And he goes, he signs off on it. I accept that. Then he has the bailiff call. And Madzo Shepherd's dead as a hammer when they're carrying him out of the courtroom. When the bullet traversed all the way through the rear back of his skull, through the center, dead center of his skull, and comes out between his eyes. And the bullet doesn't exit, but it pushes out to where it's like a knot. So it busts the back of the skull, traverses through the brain, and pushes out the front. And Dr. Trey, the statistical probability of him surviving that is probably nil. Would I be guessing right?
Yeah, you get shot through the head through and through, and usually you're dead.
Usually you're dead. And so,
well, but we know a lot of people. We know a lot of people are brain dead, and they're still walking around and voting. So,
right.
It doesn't quite count.
So they carry him over, and then he has the bailiff call. So they have it kind of made up, and he has the bailiff call, and they have taken the body to the hospital. And, bailiff calls, they answer. He says, how's Shepherd doing? Oh, he just died. He's not being dead 2 minutes. We're about to call you guys. So in the papers, I promise. And so the paperwork, the way the paperwork had to flow with the judge, they passed sentence before they got an official time of death. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
so,
they had to pronounce him
first.
Dead.
That's right.
He was pronounced dead. After
yes.
Whatever time the verdict was rendered, he died seconds after, according to the coroner.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why
yes.
You don't let people die in the operating room. They always die in the recovery room because
right.
There's more paperwork to fill out if they die in the operating room. And
so
we
that,
hate paperwork.
That's
so, you
know. That's right. So
that's too funny.
I thought that was a real interesting fact, too. But any more questions before we talk about?
Well, yeah we got
Kyler
Smith has a question because he's our other co-host. And then I will
all
introduce
right.
Devin, who's come back on. So, Kyler, what is your question or comment?
Actually, yeah, I've been kind of speechless. Like the way Trey was saying that the jury can just say you're not guilty, even if you are, if it's, justifiable, that's insane. That's crazy.
And they can't be retried.
No.
Yeah.
Especially Shepherd.
Because, that's it. They're found not guilty. Double jeopardy.
That blows my mind.
That's it. That's all there is to it. Can't do it. So that's why the guy got to go live in California.
What?
Mm-hmm. He did leave town, it sounds like. He didn't hang around town
yes.
for long.
He did not hang around town for very long at all, just long enough to gather his belongings. And he moved around out west quite a bit and ended up in California in the, you know, for the last part of his life. But,
now the Hatfields and McCoys, they were West Virginia, weren't they? Were they Kentucky or West Virginia?
Pike, well, and that both you have a divide. The border runs right through Pike County, which is, I guess, north of us. And one side lived in West Virginia, one side lived in Kentucky.
Yeah, so they didn't want to do a Hatfields and McCoy and an endless retribution. So they probably suggested that it would be good to move.
Now we can get there's some really, really cool facts going to come out here in a second from an eyewitness. Stanley remembers this very vividly. You know, he's 87, soon to be 88, and this is the first time Stanley had talked about it. He had just told his children 10 years ago about the murder. He didn't tell them. He was in his 70s before we ever talked about it. So, Stanley came in after the phone call and the revelation that I was related, very closely related to them. They came in. They wanted to meet me and things, and I wanted to meet them. So they came in, and we gave them a tour of the courtroom. And Darla and I interviewed him in the courtroom. And I let Darla take it from there. You know, she shot a lot of video, and it was a really, really cool day, wasn't it, Darla?
It was. One thing that we did learn, we assumed it because he went as far west as you can go without, you know, going into the ocean. And everyone involved that survived seemed to leave Harlan as quickly as possible. Howard Hensley, he went to prison, but was released pretty quickly. I mean, it wasn't years and years. I think it was maybe a few years. And meanwhile, his wife and family, they leave. They go to Ohio. And it just seems that everyone involved knew that Harlan was probably not going to be for them anymore for obvious reasons. Yes, there was going to probably be this family feud that topped the Hatfields and McCoys. So they all leave. And obviously, Tony did not know that Howard Hensley was his uncle. No one talked about this. Tony's grandmother.
My grandmother.
Never discussed it.
Correct.
Tony probably met Howard Hensley at some point in his life and didn't even know who he was talking to because it was never stated that, you know, he had ever murdered anyone. So everyone just kept super quiet about it. Stanley Hensley, he kept this a secret. A lot of it was shame. A lot of it was fear, I think. Stanley's mother went on to Ohio. She became what he referred to as a Rosie the Riveter. She worked in World War II surplus, making machinery and Goodyear and all that during the war years. So they started over. And when they started over, they never discussed it again. And he finally decided to talk about it just probably about the time that Tony started researching it. So it was quite incredible for this fella to come back and actually get to see one of the places that probably defined where he lived as an adult, really. He for all practical reasons, he should have just grown up and lived in Kentucky, but because of that one incident, he never lived in Kentucky again. He went north. So it was really great. He this fella and his family. They brought pictures, and it was almost like a reunion. It was really awesome to see, and they found a new family member in Tony, and it was just a really awesome experience to get to actually witness this person who's almost 90 years old go back in the court, the courtroom in which they had not been since they were a small child, and witnessed a traumatic scene there. I can't imagine. And he also remembered being separated from his mother, which I thought was just, that would have to be so scary for a child. And he finally found her outside. It was chaos, according to him.
I can imagine. And by the way, we now have Devin Tate, who has joined us from West Hollywood. Devin, how are you doing tonight?
Hello, I'm great. How's everybody?
Hello, Devin. Fine, hey. Devin. How are you doing?
Good. Sorry I'm late, but better late than never.
That is exactly right. And now, Devin, I'm going to pull a surprise on you. There was a time when you relayed to us an incredible murder story that took place in Paradise, Kentucky, correct?
It was outside of Paradise, Kansas.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Not Kentucky. Kansas. But anyway, you know, I remember that there were a lot of folks involved. And remind us of that story. But it's such a good story. And you weren't with us at the first part of this, but I want everybody to remember this, because back when we were doing Murder 123, which was short-lived because we got a lot of flack about it. People didn't like that show. But Devin, do you remember enough of that story that you can tell us just a couple minutes about it? I mean, it's another one of the great, and I hate to say it, it's another one of the great American murder stories. So can I say that?
Yeah. For sure. And it was happened right in the area where I grew up, and it was somebody I went to school with. So that, you know, definitely brought it close to home for me. So I remember a lot of the details, a couple things I might not have right, but essentially there was a guy, Roger is his name, and his girlfriend, and they were kind of small time drug dealers in the area, probably did a lot of their own supply, probably did some other illegal things. But I think their main thing was selling, you know, crystal meth and probably some other drugs. And Roger had a cousin down in, I believe it was in Mississippi. And I think what happened is they drove down to Mississippi I think they were trying to get some money out of the cousin. I think they had some financial troubles, or they needed money to do a drug deal or something. And for whatever reason, they believed they could get it from this cousin. So they went down to the cousin's house, and I believe they were the only ones there. I think some things happened, and then eventually Roger and his girlfriend left, and nobody ever heard from the cousin. So people started to get suspicious, and they kind of looked in the house, and they saw that some carpet had been removed, looked like there had been some blood. So it was kind of obvious what might have happened, but there was no bodies. So it took a while for the law to catch up with them. But eventually, from Mississippi all the way back to Kansas, they tracked him down to a farm out in the middle of nowhere, an abandoned farm, and they found the chopped-up bodies of the cousin and the cousin's girlfriend in a refrigerator or a freezer on that abandoned farm. So then it, you know, became apparent that what had happened was Roger, you know, was trying to get this money from his cousin, didn't work out, threatened him and ended up killing him and his wife or girlfriend. But it all took quite a long time for everything to come out and for them to actually go to court. And now they are both obviously in jail as a result of that.
I mean, just an amazing murder story, just kind of like the Manzo Shepherd case. All over the country, there are these incredible stories. We've talked about Jeffrey Dahmer. We've talked about so many people on Murder 123, and maybe it's the best that has gone by the wayside. But anyway, Tony and Darla, tell us the last chapter of what all has gone on with this.
Okay. Whenever that Stanley came in, you know, we were all glad to see each other, meet each other, and then, you know, we interviewed him. Now, he recapped the murder from the perspective of a 7-year-old. Okay, he's in the courtroom the day Manziel Shepherd is murdered because his dad's on trial too. Not that, you know, they were going to try Manziel, then try his dad, then try Klaus all in the same day. So he's sitting in one of the pews on the outside. Whenever Jack Heaton walks up to kill Manziel Shepherd, he just about brushes little Stanley. Stanley looks up and sees the guy that's going to kill Manziel. He walks up. He says he sees him lean forward, a big pop. He said people go crazy because they're thinking everybody's going to start pulling guns. Now, how Heaton got that gun that day, they were patting all the men down, but it was bad form to, in 1942, to pat a female down. So one of his 15-year-old cousins got the gun to Heaton. That's how the gun got into the courtroom. So bedlam ensued after the gunshot. There were two doors, two entrances to the courtroom. So you had 300 people coming down, and then you had a balcony. So you had people running down the balcony steps trying to get out, and you have all these other people trying to get to these doors. You have the prosecutor and defense diving under tables. And Stanley's mother got pulled one way. Stanley gets knocked in the floor. Stanley is being trampled to death. And somebody picks him up out of the floor. And he finds his mother. They take him in, and he finds his mother outside on the courthouse grounds. Now, Stanley tells me a little backstory about right before the trial. Howard had brought the murder weapon home and cleaned it up and hid it in a wall. He asked there, and they live in a coal camp. Now, not a lot of money, not a lot of food. And she says, "Hey, the children are hungry. Do you have any money?" And they've taken this money from Joe Christian, obviously. He says, "I have more than what I left with," and gave her a few dollars to buy food, and then he left again. So after he's found guilty, Stanley's dad, Howard, is found guilty, they are, and he said that his dad was a bad guy. He says he remembers his dad beating his mother, mean to his mother, plenty of work, but he just was wanting to run the roads and not be a family guy. And Manziel's sisters apparently took a liking to any Manziel's friends, so that's part of the draw to Manziel Shepherd. It's not really Manziel, but his sisters. That's the backstory. So the coal company comes to them and says, "You have so many days. You either got to remarry or you have to leave." Now, in those days, in the 40s, 30, 20s, 30s, and 40s, up to, you know, the late 40s, if you lived in a coal camp and the husband got killed and there wasn't a male child old enough to go into the mines to take his place, or a single miner that would marry her and take on the responsibility of the family, they would gather your stuff up and take and set it on the side of the road. And if you were lucky, they would take you into town and set you out. But they would take all the possessions women, children, grandma, whomever was in the household, and just basically outside the coal company boundaries, that's where you were. So the miners took up a collection for Stanley's mother and family. They got into a little town called Kaywood. They were able to get out of there. And during this period, there was a job fair. World War II was going on. They were looking for workers for the factories. So Stanley's mother had went to the job fair, and she was promised a job in Ohio. And I'm not going to give the exact location, at a Goodyear plant. So all she had to do was raise enough money to get there. So he's not sure who gave her the money or how she got the money, but she got the money, got the job, worked a little bit, come back and maybe took the daughter with her. And Stanley had a sister that was younger than he was. She was in the courtroom too, but too young to remember anything. And he goes into she puts him into a Presbyterian boys' school. So she's building another life. He's in a Presbyterian boys' school. She becomes a Rosie the Riveter. I have some of the photographs and some of the planes that the part she worked on went to, and also in her Rosie the Riveter uniform. That was a real thing. That just wasn't a poster. That's what they wore in some of the factories. And so Stanley graduates high school. He moves back in with his mother. At this time, she's remarried. She's established. And Stanley wants to go to college. So Stanley has to work a year because there's no such thing as student loans back in those days. So Stanley works a year, saves up enough money, goes to college a year, works a year, goes to college a year. And he ends up graduating and getting a job at the same plant that his mother worked at. He worked there until he retired. He had a family, all of them very successful, very nice people. And Stanley retired from that Goodyear plant after many years of service. Now, what Darla and I think the best part of the Manzo Shepherd story is just put yourself in Stanley Hensley's position. 7 years old, you've seen your father be really mean to your mother. You've been... Your father's accused of murder. You're trampled in. You see a guy get killed. You're trampled in the courtroom. Your dad goes to prison. You pick up and you're put into Presbyterian boys' school. How many people would have chosen a different path? How many people would have fallen into the same cycle as what Stanley's dad did? I think the greatest lesson that we take from the Manzo Shepherd story is that Stanley Hensley took all those negative things that happened to him in his life, and he told me, he says, when I was in school, I promised myself I wasn't going to be like my father. And I worked and I worked and I worked, and he built, like I was saying, had a really nice family, really stable environment, was there for all the kids, all the grandkids. So is Manzo at the end of the day, is he the focal point, or is this man that turned all that adversity in life and turned out really positive and had a really good family, and they turned out really positive? So to us, that is the ending, going to be how we end the Manzo Shepherd story, is telling the Stanley Hensley story.
Well, that's great. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask our four co-hosts to weigh in. Dr. Trey, what do you think about what you've heard? And I think this has been revealing and really exciting.
Well, it's a great story, and it's in. And if you're concluding with it that this young boy lived his life to a code, that he changed the way of what he saw to become an upright and good man, I think that's a great way to end the book.
Yes, he did. That's what we think, too. And he's one of the nicest people that you'd ever meet, one of the most just jovial, friendly folks. Darla, I mean, what was your takeaway from meeting Stanley and his daughter? I mean, they were just normal and just nice.
They were wonderful people. They had overcome a lot, especially Stanley in his life. And the one thing that I loved is that he wasn't bitter. He seemed happy, and he lived his best life. And I was super proud of him because of that. And another thing that I guess besides such an inspiration that Stanley is, I love the fact that Tony was closely related to the story. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that somehow there was some sort of genetic memory that just he kept driving, that kept him going and just researching every avenue that he possibly could for years. And now I see why it was his passion, is maybe because it was about that was a family story, not just a true crime story.
Wow. Yeah, I wasn't going to let that one go. Yeah, I've been doing it for close to 10 years, and there's something I kept digging at every little piece I could find, and it was hard to find. It wasn't, you know, once you figured out where to go, you could find little pockets of information, but nobody locally remembered anything about the Shepherd murders that Manzo was killed in the courtroom. And everything, and they had everything at Black Mountain, they had right. And Manzo was killed in the courtroom, they had right. Everything else about the story, the locals had wrong.
Wow. Well, you guys have put it back in perspective for everybody. And I've got a quick question for you. Is there like a second edition that's going to come out of this book?
I'll let Darla answer that one.
We think so. We think that there's more to the story than we actually told, and we think that there's an even better story that we can tell and tell Stanley's side of it and his part of it. And so it's going to be just an addition or a conclusion to an already really riveting story. But it's going to have a much different ending. It's actually going to have a good ending. There's never you never think of a good ending with two people being murdered. But then you hear the rest of the story and what happens after and how people find family, find strength. And I think it's going to be an excellent addition to one of Kentucky's most interesting true crime stories.
And also with Stanley, he could be, when this gets, our hope is that when people read this book, they really enjoy the historical part of it, but what they take away from it is you can break the cycle. You can do this. You don't have to be a victim. You know, just with hard work and perseverance. I think that is Stanley's message, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's
good. And thank you for that. Devin Tate, do you have any comments or questions for our guests?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, there's a lot of things about our justice system that don't work so well, but there are things that work pretty well. And one of those is, you know, vigilante justice, when people, you know, finally are fed up and take things into their own hands. And then what Dr. Trey was talking about with the jury, you know, I was on a jury myself a few years ago, and it was kind of incredible because, you know, they made this court case drag on and on and on, and they used a lot of legal terms that were, you know, things that we had never heard of and had to be explained, and kind of made it really more complicated than it should have been. But when we got in the room to deliberate, every single person on the jury was thinking the same thing. So it was very easy. We had all heard the same thing. We'd all come to the same conclusion. But when we were filling out the paperwork that they make the jury fill out, the questions themselves were very confusing. So we answered it the way we thought, you know, we were trying to do it. And when we gave the paper to the bailiff and they showed it to the judge, they came back and they said, "We think you might have put this the wrong way. We think you might have meant to say yes here when you meant no." And they explained to us what it meant, and we all said, "Okay, yes, no, you're right. That's, you know, we were confused by the question." So in that case, you know, it was really cut and dry, and I believe the system actually worked. But I know that's not always the case with our justice system today.
Wow, that's an amazing statement. Kyler Smith, what do you have to say or to comment about what we've heard?
I was just going to agree with Tony when he said, you know, there's always a way to turn it around. There's always two different types of people. Either the one you see this stuff growing up and you turn into the same type of person, you just keep on going, or you use it as a lesson and you decide that it's never going to happen again and you're much better than that. So I thought that was really cool.
Well, great. Well, thank you. And Mark Johnston, what do you think? You're getting the last word.
I was curious, what type of murder weapon was it in the courtroom that was used, like a revolver?
Yes, it was a 32-ounce head revolver that actually only was capable of firing that one shot and the cylinder locked up. Back in those days, you used a lot, black powder was still fairly prevalent in your loading your ammunition. So someone had shot it and never cleaned it, and so it fired that one round in the slot. That's all he needed, you know, obviously. But it locked up. They make mention of that in the newspaper articles that that after the first round, it was inoperable.
Interesting.
Wow. Well, that's great. Well, all I've got to say is, Tony and Darla, it has been a pleasure to have you on here tonight to revisit the Manzo Shepherd case and find out that our one and only Tony Pelosi is related to this guy, and we have learned so much about what has happened in the interim. Because you know what? As a guy that writes books, I know that when I'm writing them, I do the best that I can do, but the longer I go, the more information I have. So I wanted to say thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you here. I'll be doing a call around to everybody on the show tonight, and next week we will have, now tomorrow night on Houston Bigfoot with Kyler and I and Mark Johnston and Trey, you're welcome to come on. We are going to be talking to Matt Delf and Elijah Henderson about the Dogman problem up there in the land of the lakes, land between the lakes. And then next week we will have Elijah Henderson on here to talk about Appalachian sorcery, which is going to be a phenomenal episode. So I wanted to thank everyone for being here. We'll see everyone next week on the one, the only Scarycast.
Thank you and goodbye.
Thank
good night.
You.
Good night.
See ya.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.